Remember I said on the first day it would get a little sparse in here by the time we got to the end of the term?
Yeah.
We have one chapter left. And that is called the chromosomal basis of inheritance. So we're considering things at the chromosomal level in this chapter more than at any other level. And in the opening slide we see exactly the same cross that we already considered in an earlier chapter. What kind of cross is this? More specifically. It's true that it is a hybrid cross. What makes it a hybrid cross? Or what makes any hybrid cross a hybrid cross? The parents that are crossed, yes, differ in their traits for whatever characteristic is being considered. That's in general what makes it a hybrid. But what this is a dihybrid cross. Why is it a dihybrid cross?
There's two traits.
No, there's four traits. Right, there are two characteristics simultaneously being tracked. What are the characteristics? Seed color and seed texture, correct. So this is nothing new at all. We already talked about this cross. The results aren't any different here. But what is different, as you see in the drawing, is that we're looking at what's happening at the chromosomal level. All right, now chromosomes carry genes because genes are simply parts of the overall length of the chromosome, the overall length of the DNA that's part of the chromosome. And what do we call the place where a gene resides on a chromosome? It's locus, yes. So the gene locus in each of these drawings is represented by the little black mark on the chromosome. All right, now we see here that two types of chromosomes are shown here. Do you see that it's two? Why two? I mean, why is the answer two? If I had asked you how many chromosomes types there are, you would have said two? Right, you have two that, well, in general, what makes two chromosomes the same type is that they carry the same genes. They have the same gene loci, which is the plural of locus. Same set of genes on two chromosomes of the same type. Whereas two chromosomes of different types have totally different types of genes on them, controlling totally different characteristic sets. So there are four overall chromosomes here, but two types. And therefore, what can you say about the cells? They're diploid, because there are two of each of those two types. Now, there's more than two chromosomes in the cell. Peas don't have an N of two. It's just that we don't care at all about the other chromosomes because they're not carrying genes corresponding to either of these characteristics that we're caring about. All right, we're just ignoring all the other types of chromosomes, however many there are in pea plants. So there is the chromosome that carries the Y gene, and there's the chromosome that carries the R gene. The Y gene controls what? Right, seed color. And the R gene controls seed texture. All right, now, as we've said before, the first time we looked at this cross, each of the genotypes of the two parents originally are four letters long because they're diploid genotypes, right? So there's two Ys and two Rs in each genotype. and you have a doubly homozygous dominant parent crossed with a doubly homozygous recessive parent. Upper Y, upper R crossed with lower Y, lower R. All right, so nothing new there, but we can see where the genes are. These two genes are on separate chromosomes. In other words, the color gene is on some chromosome, whatever number it is, that is not the same chromosome as the chromosome that carries the other gene. All right. Now, meiosis is going to randomly choose one or the other of those, right? But it simply doesn't matter when you have a doubly homozygous parent. It doesn't matter which uppercase R gets chosen or which uppercase Y gets chosen. You're going to have a gamete looking like this for this parent and looking like this for that parent. That's why when you get these two parents together, since they're both doubly homozygous or doubly true breeding, there's only one possibility with respect to the genotype concerning only these two characteristics. What is every offspring going to have as a genotype? Yeah, that's the F1 is the offspring, is the group of offspring of the parent, the parental generation. If you have to have this gamete from one parent and you have to have that gamete from the other parent, then what is every offspring going to have as the genotype? Well, what is the whole genotype? Correct. Every one of them is going to be the same. Upper Y, upper R, lower R. Because that's the only possibility when you have only those two types of gametes being able to be produced by the parents. All right, so this is all review at this point. This shouldn't be new. Every one of the F1s is going to be a doubly heterozygous individual. And therefore, because of complete dominance for both of these genes, they both operate in a Mendelian fashion. That means every one of the F1s are going to be doubly dominant in phenotype, right? Every one of them is going to be yellow because yellow is dominant over green, and every one of them is going to be smooth because round is what the R stands for. Round is dominant over wrinkled. Right? But you can see their chromosomes here. Then we get to these boxes, colored boxes. And these are two laws that Mendel came up with, even though he didn't know what chromosomes were. And you can see that they are the law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. Well, first, the law of segregation. In everyday language, what does segregate mean? Yes, segregation means separating things, putting them in their own places. And so the law of segregation gets its name because even though he didn't know what was happening molecularly, he was describing something that happens in meiosis. Law of segregation refers to the fact that in meiosis, the two alleles for each gene separate to produce those gametes. Right, you have two alleles. The two alleles for a gene means the two alleles of the same gene. So the two R's here are the two alleles. The two Y's are the two alleles for a different gene. But the point is that when meiosis 1 happens, after metaphase 1, you have the actual separation that's occurring in anaphase. One of those two alleles is going to go to what will become one cell, and the other allele of the same type or of the same gene is going to go to what is going to become another cell. That's the segregation. Right? And that's a big deal when it comes to heterozygous individuals producing gametes, because a heterozygous individual has two different kinds of alleles for that gene. Up here, there was, for this gamete formation, also segregation. But when you're separating an upper Y from an upper Y, it doesn't matter. Each of the two cells is going to get an upper Y. Here, it does matter. Okay? And the same thing for the Ys. The Ys are going to separate from each other. So, law of segregation really just refers to what happens in anaphase 1 of meiosis. The law of independent assortment is named after something we've already covered, independent assortment, right? What does independent assortment refer to? A lot of that information is correct, depending on what you mean by your pronouns. What is it that's lining up? Homogeneous pairs line up during what? When is this happening also? Specifically. Right. In metaphase one of meiosis, of course, like all metaphases, there's a lining up of things. But what specifically line up are homologous pairs, which can also be called what? What's another name for one homologous pair? A tetrad, correct. So that's what lines up at metaphase one, tetrads. But how one tetrad lines up is assortment. That's what assortment by itself means. Independent assortment means each tetrad independently lines up. It's not affected by how the other tetrads are lining up. And so, in a sense, each tetrad flips its own coin rather than one coin being flipped to determine how all of the tetrads line up. That's why you can have the situation right here. Two different situations. One in which both of these tetrads lined up with red going one direction, blue going the other, or the other possibility. These two tetrads lined up so that each of two cells is going to get a red and a blue. Right? When you ignore all the other chromosomes because they're not involved in these two characteristics, then these are the two possibilities. These are the two possible ways to independently assort. Remember I gave you that formula of 2 to the n minus 1? Here there's 2 because even though they have more than 2 chromosomes, we're only considering 2 chromosomes, so 2 to the 2 minus 1 is 2 to the 1, which is 2 overall possibilities, specifically these two possibilities. But anyway, that's what law of independent assortment refers to. And because of the way this happens, that means there are going to be different kinds of gametes produced from a heterozygous individual. Not all the gametes are identical to each other with respect to even just these restricted set of traits, characteristics, or genes. But anyway, that's exactly the same cross now. We're just looking at the genes on specific chromosomes. And one important thing to keep in mind about this is that we've been talking about genes as though they occur in isolation before this chapter. But of course they don't. Every chromosome has thousands of genes on it. Even though we're only paying attention to one, it's not that gene by itself that moves, right? That gene is moving as part of a chromosome. And chromosomes individually can move their own way, but each chromosome, wherever it goes, all of the genes, however many there are, that are on that chromosome, move in the same direction. Keep that in mind. All right, now on slide 2, we're looking at a close-up of some fruit fly eyes. Fruit flies are used often in genetics experiments. for various reasons. One is that their fruit flies are really easy to breed in the lab, and they have, it only takes about a week for them to produce a generation. So you can go through a lot of generations without having to wait very long. Anyway, fruit flies are belong to a genus called Drosophila. If you see that word, that's what they're referring to, fruit flies. And here, we're concerning ourselves with eye color. Now, really, eye color is not as simple as this suggests. It's not just one gene that actually determines eye color, and there's all kinds of different eye colors possible. But for this example, we're restricting our attention to just one gene, and there are only two traits in this governed by this particular gene that we care about. So the wild type trait is this red eye. This is the wild type color. Most fruit flies, when you see them in nature, will have that color. In fact, if you look closely, if you leave bananas out too long, you start getting fruit flies, even without putting them under a dissecting scope. You can just, with your naked eye, see their eye colors. Most of them are this reddish. Every once in a while, though, you can see a white-colored mutant, white eye color. Let's see what's going on here. This is not like any of the other examples we've studied so far. But slide 3 illustrates what's happening. Now, it looks like it's no different from the examples we've looked at before, because we have one parent crossed with another. They differ in their traits, right? So it looks familiar. You have a red-eyed individual crossed with a white-eyed individual. But what information do we see up here on that top line that we haven't cared about before?
Gender,
right. In all of the previous examples, we didn't care which one was the male and which one was the female. We didn't indicate it because it didn't matter at all. For instance, on the one we just talked about, the peep shape and color one, it could have been the male that is yellow smooth and the female green and wrinkled, or the other way around. The results would be exactly the same because it doesn't matter. And the reason it doesn't matter is because those genes for seed color and seed texture are on autosomes. Do you remember the word autosome? What is an autosome? Right. Any chromosome in an individual other than a sex chromosome. Not all species have sex chromosomes, but fruit flies do, just like humans do. Okay, so remember, we looked at the human karyotype. There are 23 kinds of chromosomes in a human. The first 22 of them, 1 through 22, are autosomes. And then you have a sex chromosome pair. All right, so all of those ones that we've been talking about, all the genes that we were talking about up to now were on autosomes, not on sex chromosomes. This one happens to be on a sex chromosome. Okay, this fruit fly eye color gene is on a sex chromosome. And therefore, we call this a sex-linked characteristic or a sex-linked gene. A sex-linked gene is simply any gene that is on a sex chromosome rather than being on an autosome. The other genes are just called autosomal genes. Or you can, by correspondence of a gene with a characteristic, we can talk about autosomal characteristics. This is a sex-linked characteristic, sex-linked gene. But like I said, it starts out as though it's really no different. We just have written down the genders. And by the way, if you don't already know that, this is the symbol for female, that's the symbol for male. Okay, now, it It's also, even after you do a cross, it looks like it's no different. Because you have red-eyed female, white-eyed male. They differ in their two traits, right? And if there is dominance of one over the other, which there is, red is wild type is dominant over white, then you would expect, even for an autosomal gene, for every one of the offspring to be dominant in their phenotype, right? That's what we've talked about all along. F1s get a dominant gene from one parent, and therefore they should be dominant in their phenotype. Well, all of these F1 offspring do have red eyes, which is the dominant phenotype. So it looks like it's the same, but it really isn't behind the scenes. All right? You then cross the F1s, and it even still looks like it's the same. Because what happened for flower color in pea plants, for instance, when you produce the F1? I mean the F2, by crossing two F1s. What did we get? That's the F1s, but I'm talking about when you cross the F1s to produce the F2 in the flower color. What happened in the F2? Well, that's one possibility, yeah. But what's the familiar Mendelian genotypic ratio, or phenotypic ratio, I should say, in the F2? 3 to 1 what? 3 what to 1 what? Well, what's the Punnett square look like when you do that for the flower color? Purple to white is purple and white. Did you say pink? Oh, okay. Yeah, because the cross for the F1s by the F1s is this, right? And therefore, the Punnett square is going to be this. Which means, based on these genotypes and the fact that it's complete dominance, there's going to be a 3-to-1 ratio of dominance to recessives. As far as phenotype is concerned. 3 purple to 1 white. Well, here we have 3/4 of the F2 are red and 1/4 of them are white. So it still looks like there's really nothing different about this. But this is not the same thing because of these gender symbols. What this says in the fly experiment is that in the F2 generation, 100% of the females were red-eyed. No matter how many you produce. Half of the males are red eye and half of them are white eye. Okay? So that does not happen if it's an autosomal chromosome. I mean an autosomal gene we're talking about. Well, let's look at why this happens at the chromosomal level. That's what the bottom half after the word conclusion is all about. It's the same cross again. We're starting over with the P generation here. But we're looking at the chromosomes now. This is a sex-linked chromosome. I mean, a sex-linked gene, which means it's on a sex chromosome. But sex chromosomes are called different things in different species. Fruit flies actually use a system that goes by the same name as our system, the XY system, meaning there are two versions of a sex chromosome, an X version and a Y version. And they are not, and this is really what's behind the fact that you can have sex-linked characteristics have gender being affected by that. The reason is that two sex chromosomes are not completely homologous. Like the two number threes, for instance, which are autosomes, those are completely homologous. Meaning each of those two number threes are going to have all of the genes that are on that chromosome. Each of them is going to have. So you're going to have two of each of those genes. truly homologous means they're the same size, they have the same number of genes. Well, the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, even though we use the word homologous because they do correspond to each other, they're not completely homologous because they're not the same size, and they therefore don't have the same number of genes as each other. All right? Now, this eye color gene in fruit flies that we're looking at happens to be on the X chromosome, but it's not on the Y chromosome, which is much smaller than the X chromosome. So the Y chromosome has genes, but there's plenty of genes that the X has that the Y does not. All right, and so we can see that this male has an allele for eye color on his X chromosome, none on his Y. And by the way, in the XY system, the reason that these chromosomes are called sex chromosomes, what makes genetically a female is that she has two X chromosomes, just like in humans. And what makes a male genetically speaking, is that he has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, one of each. All right? So, this red-eyed female, that's the original parent, she is a true breeding, in other words, homozygous, dominant, red-eyed individual. By the way, I should say this is still another standard of genotypes that we're using here. The, you know, in other cases, like the P for flower color, we were using an initial that stood for the dominant allele, right? And then a capital was dominant and the lowercase was recessive. Here, it's kind of backwards. The W here stands for white, which is the recessive allele. But if you put a plus superscript, that means instead of being recessive, it's the wild type. So just realize that. You're using a different system here. W plus, in other words, means red. W by itself means white. All right? Anyway, she has W plus as her genotype, which is just a normal, it's just another way of using a genotype, but it's just another situation of having a homozygous dominant individual. The male is different, though. A male cannot be homozygous. Because what does homozygous mean? It means having two of the same allele for that gene. Well, a male is an XY, and there is no allele on the Y for this gene. Therefore, it's impossible for him to have two of the same, since he can't have two. And therefore, the word heterozygous, the word homozygous, those are not used for males if we're talking about a sex-linked characteristic. Instead, for males, we use the word hemizygous, where hemi means half. Half makes sense here because compared to a female, a male has half as many alleles for that gene. She has two, he has one. All right, so we don't call a male, for a sex-linked characteristic, we don't call a male homozygous or heterozygous, we call him hemizygous. And he is hemizygous white, notice. This brings up another point. Red is dominant over white, but when you're hemizygous, you only have one allele. So whatever trait corresponds to that allele, that's the trait you have. That's why he's white-eyed. Okay, so these are their chromosomes. Now they need to make gametes, right? Well, notice this Punnett square has only one row in it, whereas the other ones had two columns, two rows that we looked at. You could have two rows here, but it would be just a repeat of this first row, so it's just simplified. And that's because it doesn't matter which of this female's two chromosomes get chosen, since she's true breeding.
Right? She's going to have to make an egg with a red allele on it. The second row would be just another version of this, so they're just simplifying it. He, on the other hand, can make a sperm that chooses the X chromosome or a sperm that chooses the Y chromosome. Now, in sex-linked situations, the Punnett square not only gives you the genotype, the Punnett square gives you the gender of each zygote as well, or the sex of the zygote. So when you get an egg, which is the only kind of egg the mother can make, with an X chromosome sperm, then that individual zygote is going to be XX, and therefore female.
Okay, so you know her sex, first of all, but you also then know her genotype. This one's going to be W plus W, which means one red and one white allele. But since red is dominant over white, phenotypically she is going to be red-eyed. That's the only way you can make a female. And that's why 100% of the females in the F1 are red-eyed. You see how this is different from the other ones we've done?
When you get the egg together with a sperm, though, that's carrying a Y chromosome instead, then that's going to make an XY individual, which by definition is a male. And genotypically, that's going to be a W plus and no other letter,
because there is no allele on the Y chromosome.
So that makes a hemizygous
red-eyed individual. Okay?
Now notice that this Punnett square says that all of the F1s should be red-eyed, because she is red-eyed, he is red-eyed.
It's just that in an autosomal case, where we also got 100% of the F1s had the dominant phenotype, we just didn't care about gender. Here, they're
all the F1s are dominant phenotype, but
they reach that phenotype differently, because the females have females are heterozygous in the F1. She's a heterozygote, right? And the males in the F1 are hemizygous. Now, everyone with me so far on this? Because then we're going to go to the F2. We're going to cross two of these F1s. This Punnett square represents all of these F1s. They're all red-eyed. Now we're going to cross two of these. One, this with this. Well, this female F1 can produce two different kinds of eggs. One of them is going to... Either any kind of egg is going to have an X chromosome in it, but one kind of egg is going to carry the red allele, the other one's going to carry a white allele. And he can make two kinds of sperm, either an X-carrying or a Y-carrying. The Y-carrying one doesn't carry any allele for eye color, but the X1 does, and it carries it, in this case, the red version from him, from the F1, red-eyed. All right, so now, just like I said before, a Punnett square for a sex-linked characteristic gives you not only genotypes, but sexes. So the left half of this first column, in other words, of the Punnett square, show you the possible females. These are both XX, because they got an egg and a sperm with an X. And what this shows you is that one half of the F1 females, one out of these two, should be homozygous dominant, in other words, red-eyed, phenotypically, but homozygous dominant. One half of them should be heterozygous, but a heterozygous female is phenotypically indistinguishable from a homozygous dominant female, right? Because red is dominant over white. So this says 100% of the females, even though they have different genotypes, should be red-eyed, and that's exactly what we saw here. The same Punnett square, though, on the right column shows the males. And this says that half of the males should be red-eyed, hemizygous, and half should be white-eyed hemizygous. Exactly what we saw. All right? So this is not really, this is not your traditional 3-to-1 ratio. It's 3/4 of the overall individuals if you assume half and half will be females and males, and 1/4 recessive. That's not the same thing that's happening, though, here, because if this were flower color in pea plants, the 3-to-1 ratio means it does three quarters of the females will be purple, and 1/4 of the females will be white, and 3/4 of the males will be purple, and 1/4 of the males will be white. That's not what's happening here. All of the females are red-eyed, dominant, and half of the males are recessive and half are dominant. Okay? That's a sex-linked characteristic. Sometimes you see the phrase X-linked, which is the same thing for us, for example, or for Drosophila, or for any species that has the XY system. That's why it's called X-linked. X is a sex chromosome. But sex-linked is the better phrase, I think, because it covers the situation for even organisms that don't have the XY system. They use different names for their sex chromosomes. Yeah.
So is every male hemizygous, like every organism?
Well, for the word hemizygous only is used if you're if all you care about is a sex-linked trait. I mean, sex-linked characteristic. So yes, in that case, they are. But for any autosomal characteristic, the males aren't hemizygous. They are just like the females. They have two alleles.
Okay, females can be
hemizygous? Not truly hemizygous, but I'm going to talk about something that's similar in a little bit. Or maybe even next. I can't remember what the next slide is. No, not quite yet. But we'll get to it. Slide 4 is really just a picture of human X and Y chromosomes. So this is considered to be a homologous pair. This is chromosome type 23. But remember that we didn't use 1 through 23 in the human karyotype that we looked at. It was 1 through 22. Those pairs were truly homologous, the same size, carrying the same number of genes on each homolog. And then instead of calling it type number 23, we just said either XX or XY. Now, they're not truly homologous, but they do come together during synapsis, just like the truly homologous pairs do. But obviously, they are not the same size here. The X chromosome has a lot of genes for which there isn't any chromosome on the Y. That's why the Y doesn't have a corresponding allele. And that's why a male is considered hemizygous, because it'll have an allele here, but nothing here on the Y chromosome, because there is no chromosome there. All right? So it's a pretty drastic size difference, well, at least for humans and some other organisms. Go ahead.
So because they go together, is that going to cause crossover?
Well, I actually have wondered that before. I don't know how much crossing over does occur, but it doesn't. I don't know that it can occur because, you know, when you think about it, it would create some third size if it happened. And so it's probably prevented. I just don't know how it's prevented molecularly. That's a good question, though. You see what we're saying? If you had crossing over between a bigger Y and a smaller X, I mean a bigger X and a smaller Y, you wouldn't be trading equal parts with each other. And therefore, what you would make is still a third size. And I think that's probably disabled somehow, molecularly speaking.
But if that wasn't happening, wouldn't every Y chromosome be passed down the same information?
They largely are, because all of those things come from... I mean, this is... Yes, this is the simple answer. They can come from either a mother or a father, an X chromosome.
I mean, like,
but they don't get mixed up nearly as much as the autosomes because of no crossing over. A Y chromosome, on the other hand, has to come from the father.
Okay.
And that's why for XY animals, which we're examples of, it's the male, it's the father that determines the sex of the offspring. Because every offspring is going to get an X from the mother, and it's going to get either an X from the father or a Y from the father. The father decides what that second one is, and therefore whether it's going to be XX or XY, and therefore male or female, female or male. Well, this has to do with what's shown in slide 5. Slide 5 shows you just some examples. This is by no means an exhaustive list. And also, it's only in animals that we're looking at here. Obviously, plants and other kinds of things are sexual as well. But these are some sorts of sex determination mechanisms used by some species, including humans at the top. Well, actually, what's true for humans is true for all mammals. They use an XY system. And we've been already talking about this a little bit. The XY system is the situation in which the X and the Y are the two versions of the sex chromosome. And so look at these numbers that we see in these cells. A man is represented genotypically as 44 plus XY. Why 44? What does that refer to? Well, not all of them. How many chromosomes are in a adult male in each cell? 46, right. So what's the 44 represent? Well, you could say that as a sentence, as you just did, or as a word. Autosomes, right. There's 22 autosome types, but a human male, an adult is diploid, right? So there's 22 times 2 overall autosomes, 44, plus 2 sex chromosomes, and in this case an X and a Y. The reason you don't just list it as 46 is because the particular sex chromosomes that you have is what's determining the sex. So by listing it as 44 plus XY, you know you're dealing with a male. 44 plus XX is a female. All right, those are the diploid genotypes. They make gametes, of course. Well, a female can make only one kind of gamete with respect to sex chromosomes. She can only pass down an X because she has two X's and no Y's. So all of her gametes are described as 22 plus X, whereas a male can produce either a 22 plus X or a 22 plus Y sperm. Right? That's why he is deciding the sex. He can produce two kinds of gametes. She can produce one with respect to sex chromosomes. Of course, every one of the gametes individually is distinct when you consider all characteristics, all genes. But this is considering only the sex chromosome itself, not even a gene, a whole chromosome. And therefore, the zygotes are going to be back to diploid, either a 44 plus XX female or a 44 plus XY male. All right. That's the XY system. And that actually is exactly the same thing that fruit flies use, even though they're not mammals. Not all insects are the same, though, because fruit flies, for instance, use the XY system. These grasshoppers use what's called the X0 system. Now, that's probably often pronounced as XO, but it really is a zero, because there isn't a second type of sex chromosome. The zero stands for nothing. All right. Now notice what's happening here. The sex is defined by sex chromosomes, but there's not two types of sex chromosomes like there is for us. There's an overall 23 types of chromosomes. Just by coincidence, that's the same number. 12 types. 11 types, sorry. 11 to... No, it is 12. Jesus. 12 types of chromosomes, but a diploid has two of each of the first 11. So that's the 22. And then if there are two X chromosomes, which is the only kind of sex chromosome in grasshoppers,
then that makes that grasshopper female.
She has two X's, whereas a male has 22 pairs of autosomes plus just one X chromosome. 22 plus X. That's why it's X0. There is no second type of sex chromosome. And notice that that's weird, because that means that males and females don't even have the same overall number of chromosomes like they do for us. Right? Birds follow the ZW system, which is, we kind of talked about that in lab when you did your DNA experiment from the owls. ZW system operates exactly like the XY system, except that the sex that has one of each is the female, not the male. For us, the one that the sex that has one of each is the male. He's the XY. For birds, an individual with a Z and a W, so 76 plus ZW is the male. I mean the female, sorry. 76 plus ZZ is the male. So in that respect, it's exactly the reverse of XY, which is also Y. It's exactly the reverse with respect to who determines the sex of the offspring. It's the female bird that determines the sex of the offspring, not the male like it is for us. All right? Because a male is going to give a Z chromosome no matter what. The female can give either a Z or a W. So that's pretty easy to understand once you understand our own system. The one that is the weirdest, at least from our point of view, is the so-called haplodiploid system that's used in a lot of social insects, like bees, for instance. Here, there are no sex chromosomes. All right? Instead, there are only autosomes, and in this particular species, 16 types, an N of 13, I mean of 16. But there are two of each of those. In other words, there's diploidy in females. If there's only one of each of those 16, then that's a male. So no sex chromosomes, but what the ploidy is of the autosomes determines the sex. And therefore, males have only half as many overall chromosomes as females do. Now, what really seems weird is what happens when they reproduce. A female, of course, is able to produce eggs, just like you would expect. And just like you would expect, just like for our own eggs produced by human females, those eggs are going to be haploid, right? Because they underwent meiosis from a diploid female. What's not like us, though, is that if a bee lays eggs without mating, so there are no sperm involved, no male involved. Unlike us, in which case those eggs would simply die eventually without being fertilized, unfertilized bee eggs can actually become multicellular, become new bees. But they are going to be haploid individuals, right? Because the egg itself is haploid. There aren't additional chromosomes being brought on by a sperm in that case. And therefore, if a bee does not mate and lays eggs, that's going to produce all male offspring. Because by definition, a haploid bee is a male. So without any other mate, without any male involved, a female bee can have an unlimited number of male offspring. if she does mate, then those eggs will be fertilized, right? And by definition, be diploid, which by definition in bees means they're going to be females. So a female bee can have sons by not mating and can have daughters by mating. And this also has some more weirdness to it. Every male bee is haploid, right? The only way that's possible is if a bee does not mate, if his mother didn't mate. So all for any given male bee, he does not have a father. And he can't have sons. Because if that male mates, that's going to produce a diploid zygote, right? Which is going to grow up into a female. So a male can only have daughters, and a male does not have a father. But a male does have a grandfather, right? Because he has a mother, and a mother can be a female can be produced only by mating. So it took a grandmother and a grandfather getting together to form the mother, and then she alone produced the son. Right? And similarly, a male cannot have, he can't have his own sons, like I said, but he can have grandsons. Because if he produces a daughter by mating, then she, by not mating, can have her own sons, which would be his grandsons. So it's a little wacky from our point of view, but we probably seem weird to them. Anyway, that's the haplodiploid system. Now to six. Here we're looking at a few Punnett squares to show you some things that can happen when a sex-linked characteristic can lead to a disorder, a genetic disorder. So here, this is not only a genetic disorder we're talking about, and this isn't a specific case. It could be any genetic disorder that's on a sex chromosome. But there's a difference between genetic disorder and heritable disorder. Like cancer is a genetic disorder that you acquire in your lifetime because you damage your genes. It's not heritable, though. You don't give cancer to your offspring. Here we're talking about a disorder that's caused by the genes you get from your parents, so it's heritable. All right? The genes haven't changed, in other words. And in this symbology, a totally unfilled square means that the person is not affected by the disorder. A partially filled, pink in this case, means that person is a carrier of a sex-linked genetic disorder is a heterozygous individual, called a carrier because that person does not actually have the disorder, because the normal version of the allele keeps them from having it, but they're a carrier because they do have the mutant allele as well, which that can cause the disorder, and they can pass that on. All right, and then a dark red box means that individual is actually affected by the disorder, has the disorder. So these aren't all the possibilities, but these are three possibilities shown here. Here you have a totally normal, in other words, homozygous wild-type female crossed with a hemizygous affected individual. He has the disorder. Right? N is the mutant form. Lowercase n is the recessive mutant form that causes the disorder. Well, he has the disorder because he's a male. Hemizygous individuals have whatever trait their one allele codes for, in this case for the disorder. If you get these two together, then the Punnett squared shows you that half of their offspring should be carriers
And that would be all of the females. All of their daughters will be carriers. None of their daughters will have the disorder, but they'll be able to pass the allele on. And all of the sons will be completely normal, because a son has to get his X from his mother, right? He's XY. You can only get a Y from a male parent. Therefore, the X of any male has to come from his mother, and she was totally normal. So the sons will be totally normal in this case. Here we have a carrier female and a totally normal male crossed. And what they would expect is that half of their daughters will be totally normal, half will be carriers. Half of the sons will be totally normal, and half of the sons will have the disorder. And then the worst case of these three, like I said, these aren't the only possibilities, is if you have a carrier female crossed with an affected male. In that case, the only truly fully normal offspring will be half of the sons. The other half will have the disorder. Half of the females will have the disorder, and the other half will be carriers. And so this is just one reason why you might want to do genetic testing if you're considering producing offspring with a particular individual. All right, now to seven. Here's where I was going to get back to your question was a little earlier. It's somewhat related. If you're talking about a sex-linked characteristic, then the male and the female of the species do not have the same number of alleles for that characteristic, right? For that gene. Males have only half as many as females. Not only in humans, which are XY, but also cats, which are fellow mammals. All right, here we're talking about fur color, which happens to be controlled by a gene on the sex chromosome. So it's a sex-linked characteristic. And the fact that there's only one allele in males versus two in females means that there is a difference in so-called dosage. Dosage refers to how many alleles you have for the characteristic. For autosomes, males and females have equal dosages, right? They both have two alleles for any autosomal characteristic. But for sex-linked characteristics, females have a double dose. Females have two alleles, males have one. And there are mechanisms that have evolved for what is called dosage compensation. In other words, to compensate for the fact that the two sexes have different doses of alleles for the characteristics. And there's different ways that this can happen. For instance, one way to compensate for dosage differences in the sexes is to bring the male up to the level of the female. Even though he has only one allele, if you somehow use that one allele twice as much as either of the one alleles that she has, they'll be roughly equal. In other words, you can make it a lot easier for transcription to happen in a male. So he makes overall the same amount of mRNA as she will make with two alleles. You see what I'm saying? We're bringing the male up to the level of the female. That's not what happens in cats, though, or mammals in general. There's another way you can look at it. You can bring the female down to the level of the male to make them equal. And that's what happens in us mammals by a mechanism that is called X chromosome inactivation. Now, the X chromosome, remember, is not only a sex chromosome, but it is the bigger of the two. And in the XY system, the female has two of those. That's why she has two alleles, because the corresponding allele is not found on the Y chromosome. So X chromosome inactivation refers to the fact that in a female, before she's born, before she even gets
to anything resembling an adult. This is very, very early embryonic stage when it's just a mass of cells. Each cell in that mass of cells in the very early embryo is going to undergo independently X chromosome inactivation. One of the two X chromosomes is going in each cell is going to be inactivated. Now remember, we talked about how chromatin has to be loose during most of the cell cycle so that the code can be read for transcription to occur. Well, if you do just the opposite and you very tightly coil up the chromatin, it will basically turn that whole chromosome off. All the genes will be inaccessible. And that's what's done with one of the two X chromosomes that a female has. Okay, now let's consider what happens if she is a homozygous individual. Doesn't matter whether it's homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive. In each of those cases, both of her two X chromosomes will have the same allele on it for that chromosome, right? That's what it means to be homozygous. Therefore, if you flip a coin to determine which X chromosome gets inactivated, it doesn't matter because they carry the same allele. All right? But consider what happens with a heterozygous individual. Her two X chromosomes are carrying different alleles for the gene in question, in this case, fur color. So it does matter which one you inactivate. Well, when this inactivation occurs, as I said, it's early embryonic. It's more than one cell, otherwise it would be called the zygote still. So it's already multiple cells when this inactivation occurs. But when it occurs, each individual cell in that embryo is going to flip its own coin and determine which of the two X chromosomes gets inactivated in that cell. So in this case, a heterozygous female has an allele for orange hair and an allele for black hair. All right, now she starts out as a single-celled zygote that has a black and an orange allele. That then undergoes mitosis and becomes two cells that are identical, and then four cells, and then eight cells. You have a mass of some number of cells before it starts taking the shape of anything. Each of those cells is genetically identical. Each cell has an orange and a black. But when it comes time for X chromosome inactivation, each one of those cells is going to either inactivate the orange or the black. And all the other cells are going to flip their own coins. So you have a mass of cells, and in any given cell is in a position in that on the overall embryo that's forming. Once inactivation occurs, then all of the cells that spring from that one cell by mitosis are going to have the same chromosome inactivated as the first cell that inactivated. So if a cell in this position on the embryo randomly decides that the orange one is going to be turned off, then that means the fur in that region of the body is going to be black because all of the cells that come from that black cell are going to also be black. Meanwhile, right next to that, there could be a cell in the early embryo that turned off the black and the orange one is turned on. So that patch of the body corresponding to that position on the embryo is going to have orange fur instead. And the overall adult cat is going to be randomly spots of black and orange, depending on where the inactivation occurred. And we call females of this type mosaics. She's a genetic mosaic, which is, you know, a mosaic is like a patchwork. It's easy to tell just by looking at her she's a mosaic, but a similar thing can happen for human females, not for color of fur, but for how well they're able to sweat. So a heterozygous female human, well, if you got in there and really looked microscopically, parts of her skin would be able to sweat freely and parts wouldn't be, right next to each other. Now, if she's sweating, you can't tell because it'll be dripping over all of her skin, but only parts of her skin are actually producing that sweat, and the rest aren't. That is a mosaic. X chromosome inactivation is the reason for it. By the way, the inactive one that is so coiled up that it can't be used, that is called sometimes a bar body. Another thing named after someone. So you can see the bar bodies in female cells. It's just that they can't be used for transcription. They're turned off for the entire lifetime of that individual. All right, that's all I wanted to get through today. We'll finish it up next time.